Good morning. Many of you know me, but for those of you who don't, my name is Mitch Rhodes. I'm married to Laura Nafziger, one of Assembly's pastors. I also want to acknowledge this morning that we are gathered here on the traditional territory of the Potawatomi, Peoria, and Miami people. So, I still have some guilt about not taking over the family farm, which was at some points well within the realm of possibilities at different points in my life. Today, I want to outline my crossing of that threshold from farm boy to teacher. I'm also looking at myself and my ancestors in the long timeline of history. What people led up to me at this point, and the land they called home? Who was there before them? How does transformation happen in an individual or in the land? How does it happen over centuries? Who is the change good for, and who might it affect in an adverse way? At home, we have a monarch caterpillar undergoing metamorphosis right now in a large glass jar for all to view in our dining room. Laura, Ira, and Augie found it in Daniel and Allie Mast's yard and were given permission to adopt it the week before last. One thing duly noted by Ira early on is, wow, that caterpillar sure leaves a lot of turds on the bottom of the jar. I thought about that as I was writing this reflection. Maybe lots of input means a lot of output because that caterpillar sure did eat a lot of those milkweed leaves. Or maybe I can say that with any kind of transformation, there is going to be a lot of crap that comes along with the package. Sometimes, especially as we get closer to the start of a new school year, I wonder what would have happened if I had stayed to work on that farm, or if I were to go back now. Don't worry, Assembly, that's not happening. I'm not taking Laura away from you. I do come from a solid line of farming stock. My people came over to America as Amish, most of them originally way back from Switzerland. Many of them came through Germany, Pennsylvania, Ohio, some even through Goshen, before they eventually stopped in Iowa, between Kelowna and Iowa City. The farm I grew up on was on my dad's side. My Grandpa Rhodes' mom, my great-grandmother, was Eliza, and her maiden name was Gingrich. I'm going to talk mostly about that line. She was a second-generation Iowan. It was Eliza's grandparents who came to Iowa in 1851. They were some of the first Amish families moving to Iowa, buying land from the U.S. government, which was taken from the Sauk and Meskwaki tribes just 14 years earlier. That grandfather of my great-grandmother coming to Iowa in 1851, his name was Christian J. Gingrich, and he was born in Germany in 1817. Previously, he had farmed with his family and had a large dairy farm in Waldeck, Germany, that had been in their family for three generations. That family had immigrated to Germany from Switzerland in the early 1700s. The persecution they were enduring forced this move. The Amish belief in nonviolence was a threat to the sovereignty of Switzerland, and if the Swiss were to remain free from domination by its big neighbors or invading Turks, they needed everyone to pledge to take up arms to defend the homeland. The Amish refused and were not welcome for this and banished by the Swiss authorities. Gerald Mast, professor of communications at Bluffton University in Ohio, writing in the Mennonite in 2017, tells of some Dutch Mennonites monetarily helping those Swiss Amish and Mennonites who were fleeing to Germany. The Dutch Mennonites intervened by advocating on behalf of the refugees. They provided money and other assistance for resettlement in Germany, and they even sent delegations to visit the refugees to check on their well-being. So my people, when fleeing to new lands, were helped by other, more established people. My connection to this is that perhaps I am paying back this Dutch Mennonite generosity every day that I go to work at Chandler Elementary, and I help teach English to the mostly Spanish-speaking children of immigrants. I help them learn English not because it's a better language, but so they can be better prepared for life here. So getting back to my journey off the farm, I want to talk about my life growing up on rural Route 2, Kelowna, Iowa, traditional land of the Sioux, Meskwaki, Sauk, and Iowa tribes. I grew up on the farm in Iowa in the 70s and 80s. My dad, Dale Rhodes, farmed with his brother, Dean, and my grandpa, Eldon Rhodes. My grandpa, Eldon, was the great-grandson of that Christian J. Gingrich who had arrived in Iowa in 1851. We farmed about 700 acres of corn, soybeans, oats, and alfalfa hay. We milked a dairy herd of around 50 Holstein cows and had a few hundred hogs at any time, which we raised from birth until fully grown and ready for market. It was the land that had been in my dad's family for three generations already, since 1911, when my great-grandparents, Chris and Eliza, moved from another farm just about a mile away. Our house sat in the middle of the land we farmed, with my grandparents' house a five-minute walk up the road one way, and my aunt and uncle a five-minute walk down the road, down the same road the other way. And about my escape from that farm, I had an accomplice in that escape, my uncle down the road, Dean Rhodes. When I was young, I remember him and my Aunt Becky visiting us on furlough from their work with Wycliffe Bible translators in the rainforests of Peru. They showed us slides on my grandparents' living room walls and talked about their exotic life in South America, flying in bush planes, using a ham radio for communication, and getting up close and personal with tarantulas and pumas. But then later, they took a break from overseas living, they moved back to Iowa, and my Uncle Dean taught Spanish at Iowa Mennonite School. But in addition to teaching, he worked on the farm every day before and after school, and on weekends, and of course, summers. I remember one specific conversation down at the milk barn where I was hanging out. I was maybe 9 or 10 at the time. I think he could already sense my desire to see what was beyond the farming life, and he said to me, "You'll try to get away from this farm too, but you won't escape. You'll end up here too." He seemed kind of zen about it, resigned to the fate of someone tied to the land. But those were prophetically inaccurate words for both him and me. For Dean, it didn't happen until almost 20 years later, but he escaped the farm after all when he took a job teaching Spanish here at Goshen College in 2001. He retired just a few years ago. Was his transformation from farmer to college professor easy? Well, it wasn't without conflict. His parents, my grandparents, who were largely retired but still heavily invested and active on the farm at that point, were far less than supportive. "Well, what do you want in Goshen?" That's what they would ask him. And my grandmother's ultimate persuasive line was, "But you make such a good chore boy." This, remember, was spoken to a soon-to-be college professor. I had a much easier time leaving the farm. I didn't know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, but from early on, I wanted to leave as soon as I could. After high school, I spent a year in Germany going to high school there, living with the host family, and being immersed in the language and the culture. I even refused to speak English to my friends and host parents, even though everyone would have been fully conversant. I was determined to leave everything behind, even my first language. This transition proved to be much harder than I imagined. I didn't have a good handle on German when I started in the 12th grade at the Christian Rauchschule in Aarhusen, about 2 hours north of Frankfurt. I had friends who helped me during study hall and after school, but I still barely made passing grades that first fall. My teachers mostly spared me from outright failing grades, I think out of pity. And because I was trying really hard, I was copying and studying notes from my classmates, constantly scribbling in my running personal dictionary of all the new vocabulary I was learning every day. I was even asking questions in class when the answers, I think, were obvious to everyone else who had been listening. I remember admitting to my journal, but to no one else, that I was a fool. I had been a fool for thinking I could go there and jump right into school without knowing more German than I did. This new thing I was trying was so hard. What was I thinking? Yet soon enough, around Christmas, I noticed that the language started to come easier and school became more within my grasp. By late winter, I was even writing in my journal in German because it seemed more natural. When I talked with my parents on the phone, they actually said my English had a funny German accent, and it was not on purpose. When I came back to the U.S. to start my first year at Goshen College, I remembered an idea I had in high school of pursuing something in the sciences, maybe botany, so I could eventually get back to my roots on the farm, or at least be involved in farming or agricultural in some kind of way. But I was still in love with German and with language learning. It felt natural to choose the German secondary education major I eventually graduated with. I could be a high school German teacher. I got my TESOL minor as backup so I could go out into the world again, because lots of places are looking for English teachers. During college, I enjoyed spending summers back home working on the farm with my dad and my older brother, Chris, who was looking to take over the family-owned Rhodes Agriculture Corporation. Driving the small Ford tractor, mowing the waterways and fence rows, hauling grain to the elevator in town, making hay, feeding the hogs, mending fences, I felt connected to this long line of farmers. After graduating college, I married Heidi Siemens, and she was quite certain she did not want to be a farm wife. Farming, that's what people left. Because farming was the life that both her parents had grown up with and then left. Her dad, Mark, had grown up on a farm near Bakersfield, California, growing almonds and other crops. Her mom, Jan, who everyone here knows, had lived on a grain farm in North Dakota. So Heidi and I didn't go back to work on my family farm. We left to teach English in Japan, where we stayed for 3 years. The program we were working with in Japan had a limit of 3 years. So near the end of that time, it turned out my brother and his family, who were still farming in Iowa, they were talking about taking a few years to go to Honduras with Eastern Mennonite Missions. And my dad asked Heidi and me if we were interested in coming back to the farm during those 2 years to fill in for my brother. There was no further obligation to stay, since eventually my brother would return and I would be free to continue pursuing my teaching career. So we came back to Iowa. Those 2 years, 2000 to 2002, Heidi and I spent on the farm were kind of hard. There were no days off for me. Even on Sundays, there was about 5 hours of milking altogether, morning and evening, plus another hour of doing chores with the hogs. And even though my commute was non-existent and I was home for most meals, I was spending easily between 70 and 80 hours a week working, and I wasn't pulling my weight with any of the housework. So this was not an enticing long-term job for us, but Heidi and I felt fine with that because my brother was the one carrying on the tradition. He came back from Honduras late summer of 2002, and Heidi and I moved back here, actually to Elkhart, so that she could start seminary at AMBS, and I could start teaching in Goshen. But back on the farm, when my brother returned, he was feeling restless. The 2 years in Honduras were supposed to have been a respite for him, to let him feel rejuvenated and able to keep on farming with new energy. But when he was away from the farm, he says he didn't miss it. When he got back, he didn't feel rejuvenated. And it was also a hard time in his life because his marriage of 14 years was suddenly falling apart. It was just all too much. And my brother told my parents sometime soon after the return from Honduras that he was leaving the farm. He started work with a friend doing home repair. It was a less intense job for comparable pay. This was a very hard blow for my dad. Never mind my grandparents. My mom says it's the only time she's seen my dad cry in a very long time. So now it seems as if my dad will be the last in our family's long line of farmers. He sold all the livestock about 10 years ago, and now he just works the land. My brother does help out with the harvest every fall now, and occasionally on other times of the year when it gets busy, but his main work is still in construction. Who knows? Maybe once my father is less able to work the land, it will be my brother who leaves construction to go back to the job he left 17 years ago. I would have to say that that would relieve some of the inner angst I'll likely have when the farm is eventually put up for auction and sold to the highest bidder. But that makes me wonder, how is the farmland transformed with that change in ownership? And how has the land transformed throughout history? What happens to that money from this eventual auction sale? Really, whose land is being sold anyway? Remember I told you about Christian J. Gingrich, who bought the land in the 1850s? how did it come to be owned and farmed by his hands? Because, of course, nobody owns it. Land is not owned, at least not in the Native American tradition. When European Americans came along and needed to know who it belonged to, it was at that point considered Meskwaki and Sauk land. Let me tell you what I learned. In 1837, those two tribes, the Sauk and the Meskwaki, signed an agreement in Washington, Iowa, which is just about a half hour from my farm. In the history books, it's known as Session Number 244, Session with a C, as in the land was ceded or surrendered, relinquished. Looking at the old maps, Session 244 land is a large delta wing shape. It's like two thin back-to-back triangles stretching almost from Minnesota in the north to Missouri in the south, taking up a huge chunk of eastern Iowa. It included about 1 million acres. The surrendering of that land was a direct result of the Black Hawk War, which refers to a number of raids by Native Americans led by the Sauk chief, Black Hawk, on U.S. forts and settlements. This was in the new state of Illinois around 1832. So these Native Americans were returning from what is now Iowa, where they had been pushed. They were returning back over the Mississippi River to their original traditional territory in Illinois, trying to recapture the land that had been taken from them in the Treaty of St. Louis 30 years earlier in 1804. Sorry about this history lesson, but it's fascinating for me. That war didn't go so well for Chief Black Hawk, as you can imagine. So after he and the other leaders were imprisoned, and after about 70 deaths on the U.S. side and 10 times that many on the Native American side, the tribal leaders agreed to sell the land in eastern Iowa as part of the deal. That sell is in quotes, air quotes, sell the land. They were trying to get back their land, and they ended up losing even more land in the whole process. And that's how my people lucked into farming this amazingly fertile land. So the U.S. government sold it to the Iowa settlers for $1.25 an acre. And this government had paid the tribes only 22 cents an acre for it. So that's about 1/6 of the selling price. And $1.25 an acre in today's money, because that's what Theo asked, what does that mean in today's money? $1.25 per acre would have been like Christian J. Gingrich today paying $41 per acre, and with 7 of that going back to the Sauk and Meskwaki people. Except that good farmland in the Kelowna area today is selling for about $8,000 an acre. So what does it mean that my family has land valued over 1,000 times what the government paid its original inhabitants, even accounting for inflation? And of course, in order to farm the land, acres and acres of trees were chopped down. That's another story. Is there any part of this transformation in this story that's good? Well, my dad has been reforesting some of this land over the past 10 years. He started around 10 years ago and has been working with a tree guy from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to plant and maintain new growth of oak, maple, hickory, walnut, and cherry, among others. My brother is also working to replant trees. And it's not a lot, but it's 20 acres. And there's this other radical idea, reparations, paying money to people who have been wronged. Although no Iowa farmers I know of have been talking about this, I did learn that in February this year, a retired Mennonite minister in North Newton, Kansas, named Florence Schloniger, actually gave $10,000 to the Kaw Nation. It was a portion of the sale of the family farm, which her own great-grandfather had bought in 1879, the Kaw tribe being the previous inhabitants of the land at that time. My research and reflection in preparation for storytelling today has only resulted in bigger questions and not many answers. But it has given me a better sense of my place in the long line of people before me. Yet it also raises questions about why my people ended up where they did and what we owe to the people who were forced off the land that we came to think of as our own only a few years after their departure. What does it tell about my transformation from farmer to teacher? Maybe the takeaway is that I have been transformed by my own life experiences into someone who wants to help others in the process of big change. This connects me to my past. A son of immigrants helping other sons and daughters of immigrants find the way in their own transformation.